J.G. Ballard, the J.G. stands for Jim Graham, is a name well known to lovers of science fiction literature. Ever since he started writing 2 decades ago, he's produced nearly 2 dozen books that have established his reputation as one of the most unusual writers in the world of science fiction. Now he reminds us, in a powerful and controversial novel, of the reality that coloured his childhood in what was one of the most colourful, unreal, and brutalised cities on the face of the earth, Shanghai. Not the grey, orderly, and far more humane city it is today, but the Shanghai that existed in a China that has thankfully vanished. Empire of the Sun is a novel of memory. It begins on the eve of America's entry into World War II, when Shanghai was occupied by Japanese imperial forces. They invaded China in 1937 and controlled the city. Ballard, who was born in Shanghai, was 7 when the Japanese arrived. He grew up in Shanghai's international settlement, an oasis of neutrality, in which its European inhabitants lived the typical colonial life of that time, surrounded by servants and luxury. After Pearl Harbor, he and his family were interred in a Japanese camp, and Lungwa internment camp was their home till the end of the war in Asia. Now, what the author has done is fuse those boyhood memories into a novel that captures the nature of colonial life, camp life, and the absurdity of war. But it's all done through the eyes of a British schoolboy, also named Jim, whose attitude to the brutality and horror that surrounds him is coldly accepted as part of everyday life. And what makes the book controversial is the boy's attitude to his captors, who he admires, and towards the British, with whom he is eventually interred with. On one level, the book is a historic document. On another, it's an adventure story. In fact, it has many levels. And when I talked to J.G. Ballard, I wondered why he had taken so long to write it. Why had this novel not emerged earlier in his career, as it was the obvious one to write?
That's very true. I think for most writers it would have been the first novel rather than, as it were, the last. It's very difficult to explain. I don't understand the reason myself. I think it just took a very, very long time to forget the events that took place in Shanghai 40 years ago. And a very long time to remember them. When I came, you see, I came to England in 1946, knowing that I would never go back to Shanghai. And I was particularly aware of this in 49, when the communists took over the country and virtually sealed it off from the rest of the world. I knew I wouldn't be going back to Shanghai, and I had to make a new life for myself in England, which was a very strange country to me. It was totally unexpected. Although I'd been brought up, as it were, in a typically colonial-style British family, which observed all those things like those British institutions like cricket and British manners and all the rest of it. When I came to England, I didn't recognise anything of the England that I'd been told about by my parents. I found it a dark, small, closed, grey, unfriendly, excessively inbred country. I felt very much a stranger. I had to make a conscious effort to adjust myself to England. And part of the price of doing this, I'm beginning to put a few roots down here, particularly when my children, when I got married and my children came along, was that I had to forget China.
Fortunately, remembering it again has resulted in a book that will win him a wider readership than all his science fiction novels combined. Because of its time frame and exotic setting, the novel wonderfully recreates a China of yesteryear that will fascinate modern readers. Shanghai, after all, was the city that never slept. Rich beyond man's wildest dreams, it had the tallest buildings in Asia, the worst slums, and was savaged by endless wars. So what then were the circumstances that led to Ballard being born in that city?
My father worked for a very large firm of Manchester cotton printers, and he was sent out there with my mother in 1929 to manage the local subsidiary of the company, and I was born there in 1930.
Prior to the Japanese invasion, which was, I think, around 1937, what was Shanghai like? I mean, that's going back to your very earliest recollections of it.
It was, it was everything. The popular newspaper accounts of the day made it. It was the wickedest city in the Orient. It was a huge, corrupt and gaudy Paris, in a way, crossed with a bit of Chicago. It was full of criminals and gangsters. It was an important city politically because the communist leaders, Chou Enlai, Mao and others, were active in Shanghai in the labor unions and the communist agitation against Chiang Kai-shek's regime. They were driven out of the city. And of course, from 37 onwards, the Japanese, who had occupied the major coastal areas of China, including the main cities, occupied most of Shanghai, except for the international settlement, which they respected. So the life of the Europeans there didn't alter substantially, even after 1937. We lived within this enclave. We were allowed to pass through the Japanese checkpoints into the areas of the city that were controlled by the Japanese and into the surrounding countryside.
So in another sense, in this enclave, the foreign community lived a rather exclusive, privileged existence. At the same time, beyond the enclave, there was carnage.
Well, I mustn't, you know, ever forget that the Japanese occupation of China was accompanied by the most appalling brutality towards the Chinese. I mean, a lot of which I witnessed myself as a small boy on a daily level in the streets of Shanghai. Certainly in 1937, when they were fighting around the city, they gave absolutely no mercy whatever to the Chinese peasantry. They lived off the land, and within a very short space of time, of course, that land was totally scorched.
Outside the tram station in the Avenue Hague, the hundreds of passengers were briefly silent as they watched a public beheading. The bodies of a man and woman in quilted peasant clothes, perhaps pickpockets or Kuomintang spies, lay on the boarding platform. A tram crowded with passengers approached, its bell forcing the execution party aside. It clanked along, connector rod hissing and throwing sparks from the overhead power line, its front wheels a moist scarlet, as if painted for the annual labor union parade. The Chinese enjoyed the spectacle of death, Jim had decided, as a way of reminding themselves of how precariously they were alive. They liked to be cruel for the same reason, to remind themselves of the vanity of thinking that the world was anything else.
What sort of relationship did you yourself have with any Chinese as a boy?
My parents were quite well-to-do. We lived in a big house with, I think we had 9 servants, a chauffeur, a night watchman, whom they employed for about salaries of about £5 a year. The 9 servants who worked for my family lived in a house called the servants' quarters, a detached house attached to the main house, which was larger than the house I live in England today. But, I mean, they were treated as something, I won't say they were as subhuman, they weren't treated as subhuman, but as a very strange and alien race. These servants were very close companions of mine as a small boy. I'm talking about the pre-war period, but I knew none of their names. They were known to me, some of them, as only, I mean, one of the closest of them was one of the coolies, who was known to me solely by the name Number Two Coolie. That was his only name. I remember him vividly to this day, and there was Number Two Boy. They were talked to in pidgin English, as if they were mentally defective. In fact, they're a highly intelligent people, the Chinese. I would call them a very superior people in all respects. I've got a great respect for them. It was just part of the, if you like, the colonial relationship that is adopted.
What was the foreign community's attitude towards the Japanese who had now conquered the city? And this is, I'm talking, prior to Pearl Harbor.
I think on the whole, the Europeans accepted the Japanese presence around the city as just another phase of the endless warring civil wars and warring factions that had riven China for so many years. I think, in fact, because I can just about remember this, as we moved towards the end of 1941, most of the Europeans and Americans there realized that war with Japan was coming, and of course the Americans and the Europeans began sending their wives and children away, anticipating, I think, that war would come probably in the middle of 1942. Nobody was prepared for Pearl Harbor.
This brings us to Empire of the Sun, because your novel begins on the eve of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and consequently what happens to our hero in the book, Jim. Now, this is where your own experiences are interwoven so brilliantly that it's difficult for the reader to separate fact from fiction, in a way. For instance, in the book, during an attack on the city, Jim is separated from his parents, and he doesn't meet them again until the very end of the war, at the end of the novel. Now, did that really happen to you, Jim Ballard?
No, it didn't. And I've made this completely clear, of course, to all who've asked me about it. The book is not an autobiography, or even semi-autobiographical, as people have said. It's wholeheartedly a novel. It draws on most of my own experiences. I could not conceivably have written this book had I not been in Shanghai during the war, and in Lunghua camp, where I was interned for 3 years. But although the background settings, Shanghai, the camp, and so on, are as accurate as memory can make them, the foreground events, all the adventures through which my 11, 12-year-old hero goes, are invented. Though they draw, in some cases, on my own direct experiences. But basically, they are an invention, and the book is a novel.
You were sent to an internment camp, Lunghua camp, which is near Shanghai. Our hero also goes to this camp, Jim. Now, as we view his experiences in the entire book through his eyes, a boy's eyes, he sees things totally different from the adults. And one thing which he does, which is quite startling, is that he profoundly admires his captors, the Japanese. Did that really happen, in effect, to you when you were in camp? Did you have a certain sneaky hero worship thing for them?
Yes, I won't go so far as to say it was hero worship, but though it's true that adolescent boys do find their heroes in unlikely places, and I think it's undeniable that the Japanese do like children enormously, and we soon befriended the Japanese soldiers in the camp, and I remember in the early years of internment, when I was, I suppose, about 12 and 13, being invited to the staff bungalows in the camp where the guards lived, and putting on their kendo armor and dueling with them. But I did admire the Japanese, and to some extent I still do, although I don't sentimentalize them in any way.
Because there's such a lack of it in this situation, does food become the major preoccupation of the entire day, finding food?
I have very strong memories of the meals, if you can call them that, that we ate in Lunghua camp. It's one of the things I remember most strongly, and that suggests to me, because I can remember what we had to eat, that in fact we weren't being very well fed. The main diet was rice, sweet potatoes, and something called cracked wheat, which was an animal feedstuff. In the early year or so, we were given a very small meat ration, which was about twice a week. We each received a minute cube of gristle, about the size of an OXO cube, if that means anything to you. One's got to remember that in the last year of the war, the Japanese could hardly feed themselves. They had huge armies on the Chinese mainland, which were falling back towards the coast. American submarines blockaded the estuary of the Yangtze, and these Japanese armies were desperate for food themselves. And of course, the last thing they could think about were these enclaves of Allied internees. So I think in the last year, the food ration was falling away absolutely to nothing. I can remember, for example, that the rice that we were given was filled with just warehouse scrapings, I'm sure, was filled with weevils, which we would push to the sides of our plates. I remember sometimes counting about 100 of these. And I remember my father saying at one point, come on, you know, we've got to start eating these weevils because they contain protein, which we did.
Well, that's exactly what Jim does in the book with his weevils as well. What also intrigued me in the book is not only Jim's fascination with his Japanese captors, but also his attitude to the British prisoners who are painted in this novel as sort of whining, pompous, selfish people. Now, you say the Americans and the Dutch prisoners adapted much quicker and easier to the reality of their situation. Now, in presenting this picture of the British prisoners, were you in a way sort of exercising old grievances that happened in that camp?
I've no personal grievances, no. I mean, I won't say that all the British were like that. Many British were extremely courageous and steadfast throughout the period of internment. But there was a tendency, which I remember vividly, present well before the war began, of the British to cling to rather a very outdated image of themselves that didn't have any relevance in the world appearing around them. And these are attitudes which the British sadly still exhibit nothing to like the same extent that they did, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, but which were very, very strong in the, say, in the 40s. An attitude of invincible superiority and a refusal to face the realities of, you know, in this particular case, of camp life. I didn't form a very strong opinion of many of the British in the camp. I haven't got a very strong opinion of the British today, frankly. I'm not over-impressed by the nation to which I belong, and I think it still suffers from a huge mass of delusion about its qualities, which are ripe for, you know, revision. So I think Jim's view of the British, although perhaps a little more strongly expressed than mine, is a fair one. The sort of snobberies and class divisions that the English to this day take for granted, of which any visitor to England is immediately aware, were present there on a day-to-day basis, and they make those sort of things make for disunity and for a failure to adjust to the realities of the situation. I mean, the best example I can give, if I could just add this, is the way in which the, you know, soon after the Japan came into the war, the British sent their battleships, the Repulse and the Prince of Wales, without any sort of air escort, up from Singapore in the general direction of Japan. And they were not provided with any air escort because it was taken for granted that the Japanese planes were so inferior and their pilots so incompetent, all of whom were supposed to have bad eyesight and need to wear glasses, that these battleships were invulnerable. In fact, the Japanese aircraft was superb. Their pilots had had years of training and were the best in the world, and they sank these two preposterous British battleships within the space of about 10 minutes. That is a perfect illustration of the failure of the British to adapt to a changing world.
The coolie knelt on the ground, laughing to himself. In the silence, Jim could hear the strange sing-song that the Chinese made when they knew they were about to be killed. Around the parade ground, the hundreds of prisoners watched without moving. The Japanese turned their attention to the coolie. Raising their staves, they each struck him a blow on the head, then strolled away, deep in thought. The Japanese soldiers, Jim knew, would take 10 minutes to kill the coolie. Their whole display was intended to show the British prisoners that the Japanese despised them, first for being prisoners, and then for not daring to move an inch to save this Chinese coolie. Jim realized the Japanese were right. None of the British internees would raise a finger, even if every coolie in China was beaten to death in front of them.
Needless to say, extracts like that from the book have upset many people, in particular survivors of the Shanghai ordeal. But what J.G. Ballard is attempting to do is make us aware of the inherent weakness of colonialism as it existed in the 30s and 40s. As I said earlier, this is a book of many levels. And one of the deeper implications is the title. Empire of the Sun not only refers to the orange sun that appeared on the flag of Imperial Japan, it also is used as a symbol for the suns of the atom bombs that fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 and ended the war in the East. And the closing chapters of the novel paint a terrifying picture of life in the camp, in the Chinese countryside, and in Shanghai after those bombs are dropped.
There was a very confused period after the dropping of the atom bombs, when we didn't know if the war had ended. Even after the Emperor Hirohito called on the Japanese forces to surrender, the idea that these very well-equipped Japanese armies would suddenly place their rifles in the road and put their hands up struck us as highly, ludicrous and totally improbable. So we were very uncertain what was going to happen to us. The surrender came so swiftly. And although it's an unpopular thing to say these days, I think we were saved, without a doubt, by the dropping of the atom bombs. What would have happened to us? I can't imagine. There were rumours, which my parents and other adults I knew openly talked about, that we would be taken from the camp and marched up country to be disposed of. But it was a very, very confused time, and I remember one day, this is within a few days of the atom bombs being dropped, the guards simply had disappeared. And we were alone in the camp, and some people thought the war had ended and set off to walk to Shanghai. Others climbed through the wire and wandered around the neighbouring paddy fields. But then suddenly, the next day, I think, the Japanese guards returned, and those inmates who set off to walk to Shanghai were picked up and badly beaten up. Then, after another interval, round about the time that the war did in fact end, a week or so later, the Japanese disappeared for the last time, and we were left completely on our own. And people began to make tentative expeditions to Shanghai on foot, which was a very dangerous thing to do.
Another thing that comes out in the novel is the almost callous attitude towards the Chinese themselves. This is from all directions. No one cares a damn what happens to them. They're bombed, they're raped, they're plundered, they're brutalized. And it's presented so matter-of-factly in the novel, you know, that it becomes a horrifying thing in itself because it's happening all around en masse. And was that really the atmosphere? People didn't care a damn about the Chinese themselves at that period, and even the Chinese didn't care about the Chinese.
Absolutely. I think that's just, there have been many witnesses over the last 50 years to the total indifference that people felt, not just the Western Europeans and Americans, but the Chinese themselves felt towards poorer Chinese, certainly, but Chinese peasantry, and also the poorer people in the cities. I mean, it's difficult to imagine a society as callous and as indifferent to human suffering as the pre-war China. Cholera, typhus, smallpox were endemic. The country as a whole was swept by floods and famines, droughts, and civil wars of every conceivable kind between the rival warlords and the communists and the Chang forces. Then, of course, when the Japanese arrived in 1937, this laid another layer of terror over the Chinese peasantry. And, total indifference to the Chinese was institutionalized.
How soon did Shanghai itself come back to being even a semblance of its old self after 45?
Very rapidly, actually. Within a few months, this is a point I try to make in the book, that the whole machinery of sort of mercantile activity of a totally unrestrained character started up within a few months of the war ending. I think Shanghai was probably an even sort of wilder place in the immediate post-war years than it was before, because, of course, it was fueled by the American military dollar.
At the end of the book, Jim has hallucinations that World War III has commenced. And in a very subtle and way, you also suggest that probably it has, but it's not the sort of war we tend to traditionally think of. It's not a war of guns, perhaps. It's a war between the haves and the have-nots. And you think that, in fact, we're really at the beginning of World War III at this stage.
I think there's some truth in Jim's view of World War III. I mean, in a sense, it began then on the installment plan. And one could take the view that the dropping of the Nagasaki and Hiroshima atom bombs was marked not so much the end of the Second World War as the start of the Third. I think if you look at the context of the failure of the American and Western European powers to learn anything, really, from the Second World War in the Far East. A failure which led straight on to the French, bitter French struggles in Indochina, which themselves led on to the American involvement in Vietnam, the long struggle that the British had against various communist insurgent groups in Malaya and Borneo, and the struggles which the Dutch had in the Dutch East Indies. I think that the failure to realize that a new world was emerging in the Far East, and that the old imperial order had to give way, that failure was the, as it were, the prologue to what I think of as World War III on the instalment plan. I don't think if there is a Third World War it will start in Western Europe. As I say in the book, or as Jim speculates in the book, if it starts anywhere, it will be at the mouths of the great rivers of Asia, where the greatest, or let's say the Middle East as well, where the around the great population centres there, where the pressures between the haves and have-nots are at their most critical.
And isn't it something ironic, I'll make this the last question, but isn't there a sense of irony that the very things that Jim, our hero, admires the Japanese for during all the horrors he endures in that war period and in his camp, he admires them for their technical prowess, for their skills, their order. And these are the very things that have made the Empire of the Sun the most powerful empire today in the Far East, economically.
Yes, that's very true. I think that's the sort of final irony, that one can read my book, knowing the subsequent history, and knowing the sort of tremendous steadfastness and hard work and organization that the Japanese applied to the war, they then went on to apply to the peace. That industrial, political, and commercial domination of the Far East, which the Japanese in 1941 sought by force of arms, they in fact achieved, this is what's so ironic, within a very few years, by peaceful means, as one of the world's greatest industrial nations. A crowd had gathered below the steps of the Shanghai Club. A group of American and British sailors had emerged through the revolving doors and stood on the top step, arguing with each other and waving drunkenly at the cruiser moored by the Bund. The Chinese watched as they formed a chorus line. Provoked by their curious but silent audience, the sailors began to jeer at the Chinese. At a signal from an older sailor, the men unbuttoned their bell-bottom trousers and urinated down the steps. 50 feet below them, the Chinese watched without comment as the arcs of urine formed a foaming stream that ran down to the street. When it reached the pavement, the Chinese stepped back, their faces expressionless. Jim glanced at the people around him, the clerks and coolies and peasant women, well aware of what they were thinking. One day China would punish the rest of the world and take a frightening revenge.